Good morning, Council. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. The next case on our docket is A230249, David Calso Swan versus Heidi Blodell Moon. Appellant will have 15 minutes for opening argument, respondent 15 in response, and then 5 minutes for rebuttal. There is a Zoom recording being live streamed, and there is an audio recording that will be produced. That is the only recording that should be taken today. We'll start now with counsel for the appellant. If you could please state your name at the beginning of your argument for the record and how you'd like us to refer to you.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. I'm Elizabeth Kadem, attorney for appellant Heidi Moon. You can refer to me as Ms. Kadem. We're here today seeking reversal of essentially four of the district court's decisions following the trial in this case and a motion for amended findings and new trial. First, its decision to deny name change of the party's minor child, Sophie, to include Ms. Moon's surname as well as Mr. Swan's. Second, its decision to deny a trial continuance to allow Ms. Moon to present expert testimony on custody and parenting time issues, or a new trial on that basis. Third, its determination that Mr. Swan had not committed domestic abuse in the party's household. And finally, fourth, the district court's decision to disallow the issue of attorney's fees at trial or grant a new trial or amended findings on that basis. The district court erred in making each of these determinations, and they should be overturned on appeal quite clearly. First, on the name change issue, the district court's denial of the addition of Moon to Sophie's surname isn't supported by clear and compelling reasons, which is necessary under the name change case law. In 2023, there are many kinds of families, including many where a child grows up and identifies with two households, headed by parents with different surnames. Having a surname from each parent affirms this identity and allows the child to feel equally a part of each household. And that's been affirmed in case law as well. Here, the record conclusively shows that adding Moon to Sophie's surname would take nothing from her relationship with her father or his side of the family, but would enhance her relationship to her mother's side and reduce confusion and distress for her.
Can I ask you a question about the way you framed the issue in this case? Because at the outset of your argument on this point, it sounded to me like you said the district court did not have clear and compelling reasons to deny the name change request. And my understanding is that we're reviewing this for abuse of discretion, and the law is when there's a parent who opposes the name change that the district court has to exercise great caution, and that it's only where the evidence is clear and compelling that the substantial welfare of the child necessitates such a change that the district court is then required to grant the name change. Do you disagree with that framing?
I believe there is case law contrary to that cited in our brief. I believe it's the Foster case that states essentially the court needs clear and compelling reasons for either granting or denying. That's the standard. I don't disagree that, you know, abuse of discretion for the overall decision is the standard of review, certainly. And the case law, I mean, could be clearer, I will admit, on burdens, et cetera. I think that the district court is required to find that a name change is in the best interest of the child when there's an objection of one parent, and that here our record establishes that, and I'll touch on the Saxon factors.
You agree the Saxon factors frame the appropriate analysis, right?
Correct, yes.
The phrase comes from Saxton. It's citing Robinson, where the language is that in Robinson we noted that the best interests control the resolution of this issue, and then I'm going to ... only where the evidence is clear and compelling that the substantial welfare of the child necessitates such a change. So it sounds like the burden of having clear and compelling evidence is on your client, and it's not that the district court needed clear and compelling to deny it. It's that you needed to show clear and compelling, or your client did, in order to necessitate that change.
I respectfully disagree, and then I did look up, it wasn't the Foster case that made the statement that when granting or denying a petition, the district court must set forth clear and compelling reasons. It was actually in the LaChapelle case versus Mitten. That's on page 24 of our brief. And the Foster case does set up what I consider to be essentially kind of a two-pronged analysis. If the best interests have been shown, it's actually the parent opposing's responsibility or burden to show that there are not compelling reasons and that it isn't in a change that should be made. Admittedly, some of this language isn't the easiest, but I think that Foster lays out that essentially two-pronged approach quite well, stating the opposing parent must establish that evidence in support of the name change is not, quote, clear and compelling, and that the substantial welfare of the child necessitates such change. So that does put some burden on the opposing parent. Now, in this case, the district court at that first stage found that it wasn't in the best interest of Sophie, which I don't believe is supported by the record to any degree. On the first factor, how long Sophie had her current name, the district court simply found that she had the name for 6 years since birth and that favored retaining the name. That ignores testimony regarding the intentions of the parties to change the name very shortly after her birth, which Mr. Swan did not deny, or as how a young child she really just uses her first name at this point, which again is clear in the record, not denied. With regard to the second factor, as to any potential harassment or embarrassment that the change might cause, the district court really focused on what amounts to a red herring issue, Ms. Moon's ex-husband having the name, but failed to reach conclusions that are actually supported by the record. While there's some evidence of domestic abuse in the very distant past, there's absolutely no evidence in the record indicating that the child knows Mr. Moon or anything negative about him, would associate the name with him, or is likely to learn anything negative about him. It's conclusive that he lives on the, it was conclusively shown that he lives on the East Coast, and the district court even cited that she'd never met him.
Didn't some of the evidence come from affidavits regarding what your client said about Mr. Moon? And presumably those are a matter of public record, and the child could later find those affidavits, see the nature of the domestic abuse that was alleged in those affidavits?
I don't think that is the kind of harassment or embarrassment that that factor is really getting at. I think it's the kind that's well known in a community. You know, it's kind of a name that classmates would know, potential employers would know. Not that this child may find out by going into court records, you know, as an adult.
So, counsel, if I may, it seems to me that implicit in your argument about on this factor, the personal embarrassment or the associations with the name Moon, you seem to be overstepping. I think appellant's name is Moon, and I assume that that's one of your reasons.
Absolutely.
Okay.
It's a very strong.
So I understand that I'm getting the message. I appreciate it. But here's where I struggle as an appellate judge, right? It seems to me you're asking us to reweigh the evidence. This was all argued and presented to the district court. It does involve the weighing of factors. It does involve making a series of findings based on the evidence. That's not what this court does in an abuse of discretion analysis. We do not reweigh the evidence, and we don't make factual findings. That, for example, this child is going to associate the proposed name change more with mother than with ex-husband. We're not going to make that determination, counsel. So how do we get to your desired outcome under our standard of review?
I don't believe in this case we are asking a reweighing of the record because there is absolutely no evidence in the record that there's any sort of association with Mr. Moon, for instance. The testimony that came from Mr. Swan on Mr. Moon was essentially confusion about why Ms. Moon would want the child to have the name of an abuser, essentially. He didn't talk about how anybody knows him or it's known, but in contrast to that, there's extensive testimony from Ms. Moon about her community involvement, the positive associations with her name in her community, Edina, because of that, and also with her two sons, who are very accomplished and well-behaved, you know, do well in school. She has church involvement. She's got extensive work history in the area. And the child identifies strongly with the name already. She identifies as part of the family and has felt that she, you know, is...
So, counsel, I hear you saying you're not satisfied by father's testimony and the record is supporting the district court's determination on this issue. So I see reference to the Prax report and mother's statements in that report about the prior abuse. So that's in the record, right, counsel?
I acknowledge that there is in the record discussion of abuse in a marriage that's, you know, over a decade ended. But I don't think that the relevance is nearly as strong as the district court found or that Mr. Swan argued, and instead that there is a lot of evidence, I mean, an absolute amount of evidence that's in favor of this that really supports reversal in the district court's decision.
Well, that's what judges are getting at. That's a weighing, isn't it not?
I don't believe that you're weighing one thing over another if there's nothing in... There's no indication whatsoever about Mr. Moon, for instance, in the community, Mr. Moon's name in the community or his reputation here. There's also evidence that's positive associated with Mr. Moon because he comes from a good family. He's done well professionally. He has a good relationship with his children. So that also. But I don't think that would be weighing if there's virtually nothing and that the district court is making clearly erroneous findings saying that Ms. Moon hasn't established positive community associations and that somehow there would be harassment or embarrassment or a lack of respect with the Moon name because of any abuse from Mr. Moon. So I don't believe that's appropriate or would require inappropriate reweighing of evidence by this court. So I will move on here to some of the other issues so that we have time to discuss them as well. On the trial continuance issue, the record reflects that the district court abused its discretion in this area as well.
Why wasn't a deposition of Ms. Darcy sufficient?
Well, as described in the brief, I don't believe that Ms. Moon was able to do that because under the trial order, she needed an expert report before she could present any testimony. This would have been a trial deposition. And the record's clear, she didn't have time to do that either. Ms. Moon was a pro se party, and I think consideration should be made to that as well. And she couldn't find another expert either. So I don't think a trial deposition would have been a possible solution.
But this wasn't an example of one of the extraordinary circumstances that the trial order initially cited. I think back in July, where it was failure to, like, needing to obtain a witness. She had an expert witness. It turned out that that witness, and I understand that she also had counsel withdraw during that time and that complicated things, but that witness didn't produce a report and wasn't available at the time of trial, and she found out in August, right? And so...
Correct. And she...
The issue of the report, why does that... Why is that an extraordinary circumstance? Why isn't that an extraordinary circumstance?
Well, it's the witness being unavailable that's the extraordinary circumstance. And although deposition was presented as a possibility, in this case it wasn't a reasonable possibility because the first step, having an expert report, wasn't possible, and then she couldn't find an expert that was even available. And that that resulted in the second continuance request, which was also denied unreasonably. As soon as she found out on August 20th, she immediately acted to ask for a continuance. She was more than about 2 months out from the deadline for requesting a trial continuance, and she was still denied unreasonably because of the importance of that expert testimony and the fact that she's a pro se party. Consideration should be made to that. I have very little time left, but I'd certainly like to note on the domestic abuse issue that the district court's decision turned on the lack of a necessary relationship between mother and Jackson, and that finding should be overturned because it is clear from the record that they shared a household. And on the need-based attorney's fees, I'll rely on my brief and answer any questions on rebuttal. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Judge Bradfold, Judge Klopaki, Presiding Judge Eid. Pleasure to be here. My name is Jack DeWalt, J-A-C-K-D-E-W-A-L-T. I represent Mr. David Swan, the respondent in this matter, and Mr. Swan is asking this court to affirm the district court's order in all respects. I'll take the issues in turn. There are four issues before the court today. One is the name change. Two is the question of a continuance, whether the district court properly exercised its discretion in denying that request. Three, whether the court's finding that domestic abuse did not occur between the parties was supported. And four, whether the district court's denial of the request for attorney's fees was also supported within the record. Looking at all four, the district court was well within its discretion in making its rulings. All its rulings were supported by the facts and the law, and as such should be affirmed. I wrote down the thing that was discussed earlier. I think a fair amount of argument in brief and oral argument is asking the court to reweigh evidence before the Judge Sullivan. Question before the court on all these issues, including starting with the name change, is whether or not there was an abuse of discretion or whether there was some error of law. Judge Bradfold? Oh, I thought there was a question. I apologize, Your Honor. So looking at the issue, Judge Sullivan did review all five Saxton factors. Judge Sullivan made findings on all five Saxton factors. Judge Sullivan set forth clear and compelling reasons for finding the name change request is not in the best interest of the child. And also, as noted by the court earlier, that if there is an objection then to a name change request, it should only be granted with great caution. Some of the pertinent factors that supported the district court's ruling were, one, there is no biological connection between the child and the last name of Moon. Moon was the name of appellant's prior husband, who had never met or had seen the child of the parties. Two, appellant's claim that she had a positive relationship with her ex-husband was simply not credible. It wasn't supported by the record. She had previously characterized him to the court as a, quote, perpetrator of domestic violence during the marriage, who was found to be controlling and abusive, which resulted in her being awarded fully.
So, counsel, if you don't mind,
of course.
To respond, I think, to appellant's argument is what I would like to hear your response to appellant's argument, which I believe is that Moon is mother's name, not merely ex-husband's name, and that the district court's analysis, does it touch on that, and is there evidence supporting it?
Absolutely. Obviously, it is Moon. That's within the record, Your Honor. I don't necessarily know if that is the end-all, be-all in an analysis of a name change, and I don't think the district court treated it as such. Certainly, the district court didn't make...
No, I'm commenting simply because all of the points that you're raising have to do with husband, right?
Sure.
And I think the mother's reasoning for it's an addition of a name, right? It's Moon and Swan.
Right.
Adding Moon is about having the child's connection to mother, recognized.
I do understand the point, Your Honor.
Yeah. And did the district court analyze that, and was there evidence in support of the district court's determination?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Okay. The district court did analyze that. The district court's task when presented with a name change request is to determine, is that request in the best interest of the child? That's the job of the trial court. And largely Saxton provides the framework for that analysis. I think the court certainly could have found, for example, that there would be a benefit to sharing the last name of appellant. I don't think the fact that specific findings on that regard are particularly relevant. The district court weighed the evidence before it and came to the conclusion that due to the propensity of concern or propensity of factors weighing against the request, that it was not in the child's best interest. So just to the same extent that respondent would be unable to disentangle the last name Moon from appellant, who is the child's mother, appellant is unable to disentangle the last name of Moon, who is her ex-husband. And unfortunately, appellant has a track record in the district court of trying to characterize her relationship with her ex-husband in different ways at different times. At one point, it was a positive relationship when that would be helpful in support of a name change request. But largely throughout the history of the case and actually leading into the trial itself, adamantly characterized her ex-husband as a significant perpetrator of domestic abuse. I think that the Prax report is actually very helpful in that regard, because this was a gathering of information by Ms. Jennifer Prax, who was not specifically getting the information with regard to the name change. Now, in that context, the statements of appellant to the custody evaluator was that she had a history of domestic violence in the relationship. He physically assaulted her during her pregnancy. After a final incident, he slammed her against a wall, punched a hole, and she made plans to leave. When asked by the evaluator if she could speak to the ex-husband, if Ms. Prax could talk to Mr. Moon, appellant did not consent, stating he would not say anything positive about her co-parenting, particularly because she was currently pursuing a contempt of court motion against him in Massachusetts. Therefore, she feared any information he would provide may be either untruthful or retaliatory. I think it's also important to note in the district court's record, when looking at the question of community respect, which the court just heard arguments on, the district court's statement was that appellant had, quote, not provided exhibits, testimony, or other evidence to establish the alleged positive association with the family name. I'd also point briefly to the Saxton factors, which talk about the district court's task of looking at any potential harassment or embarrassment to the child. It's not limited to potential harassment or embarrassment within Edina community or the school community. It's any potential harassment or embarrassment that might accrue to the child with the change of the name. So again, looking at the factors before the court, looking at the evidence before the court, certainly do not see how this court's task of finding error or an abuse of discretion could occur with regard to the name change. Unless there's further questions on that, I'll move on to the next issue, Your Honors. With regard to the request for continuance, I would simply note a few things. One, the district court did, A, find us not extraordinary circumstances. B, the district court did note the ability to utilize the trial deposition, which as the trial attorney, I would say was offered on behalf of my client to expedite and try to streamline the process and not create prejudice to appellant.
Excuse me, but what of counsel's argument regarding the report issue? And why shouldn't we view the fact that her inability to utilize the expert she initially identified, Ms. Darcy, because of the lack of report, because she was proceeding pro se, didn't qualify as an extraordinary circumstance because she no longer could obtain a necessary witness?
Certainly, Your Honor. First of all, An appellant who is pro se or is not an attorney is held to the same standards of an attorney at trial. That's General Rule of Practice 1.04. It says any requirement that an act be done by a lawyer, the same duty is required of a self-represented litigant. So there isn't consideration within the rules as to a pro se party. I would say this record is rife, though, and replete with evidence of Judge Rachna Sullivan attempting to accommodate the pro se nature of Ms. Moon, or appellant. But I would also identify, Your Honor, a few things the district court called out. One, the trial order in question had come out into July. Ms. Darcy had been apparently retained by Ms. Moon throughout the course of this litigation, and yet Ms. Moon, for reasons that aren't clear anywhere, did not initially make a request for continuance until, I think, a little bit over a month later. Two.
But that was around the same time as she lost her counsel, right?
There had been several, Your Honor. I'm not going to speak offhand to that.
That's what appellant argues, is that it was around that time. I mean, the only reason why I bring it up is not for the consideration issue, but presumably it was the attorney for Ms. Moon who was communicating with the expert and would have been the one responsible for making sure that the expert had the trial date set aside and the report ready to go. And now here she is without an attorney and is having to do these things on her own. And can she even utilize the deposition option if she doesn't have a report?
Well, I would say the first, Ms. Moon has been represented by several counsel and had represented herself pro se at other times. So Ms. Moon moving a case forward once she lost counsel. Two, Ms. Moon had the trial order. And three, Ms. Moon never brought a request to the court to allow a trial deposition. It's problematic to say when you're offered a course of remedy by district court, the district court says you could have asked for a trial deposition. In fact, as counsel of record, that was offered. But that was never even requested. It's not that Judge Sullivan had a request that was denied, either formally or informally, even if we try to give consideration to a pro se party. There was no affirmative request for that to be done. What the trial record reflects, which is what occurred, trial order in July, request for continuance a month later, simply stating unavailable, no additional request for relief, no additional thing, just has to move it. Underlying this entire issue, though, if we actually try to get to the meat of why is this a problem, and that's the contraneo factors, is that Respondent Swan is a unmarried father. He had no legal rights to custody or expanded parenting time while this case was pending. So there was a custody evaluation that recommended joint legal, joint physical, and an equal parenting time schedule. We had brought several temporary motions trying to expand to that schedule, and Judge Sullivan, I think appropriately, or at least I understand why, said, I'm not going to prejudge this case, and we are not going to move to an expanded schedule until we take evidence. Ms. Moon knew that. Ms. Moon knew that further delay of that case was going to maintain the status quo, which effectively is so legal, so physical, and a restricted parenting time schedule for Mr. Swan. Judge Sullivan states in the record, if this trial were to be continued, which I think it was a November date, if I recall, my next available dates for this length of a trial is in March. That would have been another 4+ months before the case even went to trial, while this matter was already having been denied requests 2 times on temporary motions to simply ask the court to do what had been recommended as being in the best interest of the child. So when we're looking at the request for continuance, obviously appellant wants to focus on the claim need, but I think Judge Sullivan appropriately said, hey, A, there's a remedy here. The remedy is a trial deposition that could have been asked for, and I almost 100% would assume that would have been granted because of the judge's statements. But two, we can't keep doing this. This case has already been pending for quite some time. We have a recommendation for joint legal, joint physical, and equal parenting time schedule. I'm not going to go in that direction on a temporary basis, but I'm not going to further delay this case and keep a status quo in place that's not in the best interest of the children. So anything else other than that kind of analysis would be asking this court to simply put itself in the shoes of Judge Sullivan and try to determine, is this extraordinary circumstances or not? It certainly wasn't, and it certainly had extreme prejudice to Mr. Swan. With regard to the issue of domestic abuse, would simply note a few things. The custody evaluator, again, Ms. Prax, noted that on the issue of domestic abuse, there is no evidence of physical abuse, coercive controlling behavior, or even situation-instigated incidents in the relationship between David and Heidi, but rather they have a dysfunctional relationship, poor conflict resolution skills, and a deep disdain for one another. Consistent with that evaluation, Ms. Prax testified there's no domestic abuse. And the district court simply found respondent's testimony in the custody evaluation to be more credible than appellant. With regard to this question of what has consistently been claimed to be domestic abuse occurring between respondent and the non-joint child of appellant, few things to note. One, appellant was not present in the situation. Two, the record reflects that Hennepin County Child Protective Services conducted an investigation into appellant's claim. There was no finding of domestic abuse by Mr. Swan towards the child. And three, appellant told the evaluator herself that she chose not to pursue an order for protection on behalf of her non-joint child against respondent. Whether or not the court wants to characterize the non-joint child as a member of the household or not a member of the household, no evidence exists anywhere within the record that would support a finding of domestic abuse or a physical violent act or the threat of a physical violent act, either by Mr. Swan towards appellant or by Mr. Swan towards statutorily towards the child. To conclude...
Can I go back to that continuance issue?
Certainly, Your Honor.
Custody evaluation, I think, was completed in April of 2021. In relationship to that point, when did appellant lose her counsel?
Appellant lost several counsel, Your Honor. Off the top of my head, I couldn't speak to when.
Does the record reflect this is her choice to lose counsel, or was it the counsel's choice?
I couldn't speak to that either, Your Honor.
That's fine.
Other than speculation, and I...
No, would I don't want that. If the record reflects it,
I don't believe it does, other than a notice of withdrawal was submitted by Ms. Kathy Gorlin, original counsel. Ms. Nordaun, N-O-R-D-A-U-N-E, came on secondly, and I believe Ms. Nordaun withdrew shortly after the second temporary hearing, if I recall, Your Honor. The reasons for the withdrawals, I do not know.
Thank you, counsel.
Yep, thank you, Your Honors.
I'd like to ask counsel this similar question. At the time of the trial date order, July 21, 2021, did your client have counsel at that point?
She did, Your Honor. And very shortly thereafter, Ms. Nordaun did withdraw. I believe the date was August 9th. There is evidence in the record that that was because Ms. Moon was no longer able to pay her. And I think that that's an important point for a number of the issues. Ms. Moon was unemployed. She had to let her first attorney go, Ms. Gorlin, because she was unemployed and couldn't pay her any longer, and the same happened with Ms. Nordaun. At that point, she had to pick up the pieces and try to get herself ready for trial. Within about a week and a half, I think it's 11 days, she learns that her expert is not available on the trial dates that have just been provided in late July, and immediately takes action to ask for a continuance of the court.
She request a trial deposition of Ms. Darcy?
She never noticed it, that is true, but I don't think she had the prerequisite ability to have, because of the expert report, and I don't think that's...
I mean, I think counsel's point is that perhaps at that point, had she requested it, the deposition would have been allowed versus not requesting it at all because there was no report. And then now continually asking for a continuance and then having to appeal that issue?
I mean, we have a trial order that says you have to have an expert report, and it is quite standard. I don't believe that a deposition, especially for a pro se party, is a substitute for testimony either. In court, live testimony allows a court to rule out objections, et cetera, and in some ways protect a pro se party. In a deposition, you don't have that. But more importantly, when she's asking for both of these trial continuances, she's talking about her difficulty in finding experts, especially in that second request.
Was there any difficulty that she had before that April 2021 evaluator report to obtain that expert report at that point? Well, she had counsel or a number of counsel.
I'm not sure that the record reflects anything as to that. However, you know, as far as timing goes, this case was relatively young, especially considering the pandemic. We were a little over a year after when they do the trial order, and the custody evaluation process takes time. So the fact that this had been going on for about a year isn't unusual in a custody case whatsoever, especially where prejudice has not been shown to his...
Well, to that point, yeah. How should we account for counsel's argument that regardless of the pandemic and the relative age of cases that were pending at that time, we had an unmarried father who could not fully vindicate his parenting rights until after trial occurred?
First, he did not have restricted parenting time. He had 5 out of 14 nights plus some evening time. There isn't anything in the record that showed that his lack of custody at that point, temporary custody, was having any practical impact. But I think more importantly, the case law on continuance focuses on prejudice, not, you know, in life, but to your case. And there is absolutely nothing showing that there was anything prejudicing his case to delay a few months. In contrast, there is enormous prejudice to Ms. Moon. You've got a custody evaluation that turned out to be negative for her. She needs to turn around and get a contrary expert evaluation. And that was critical to her case. So when you're...
She didn't get that evaluation before the evaluator's report, it came after?
She had an affidavit from Ms. Darcy in temporary proceedings, but she didn't have an expert report, no.
And when was that evaluation?
The affidavit from the expert?
Yes.
It was in temporary proceedings in the summer of 2020. I believe, so early on in the case, but showed her importance to the case, certainly.
So and about a little less than a year before the evaluation report came down in April of 2021.
Correct. And I don't think most parties, especially unemployed single mothers, would
somewhere be... during that period of time she had counsel.
Twice during that period, there was a long period of being pro se between the fall of 2020 and the spring of 2021 as well, when the expert evaluation came, when the custody evaluation came down, she was unrepresented. Then she was represented for a short period of time and again did not have the ability to keep counsel at that point. But as far as obtaining an expert report prior to that, I don't think anyone would go to the expense. I mean, it's a significant expense prior to finding out what would happen with the custody evaluation. That would just not be a normal course of action or a good financial decision. Well, I see my time is up, so if the court doesn't have any more questions, thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both for your arguments today. The matter is submitted. We'll issue a decision in due course.
Thank you, Your Honor.
That concludes our proceedings for this morning. Well, good afternoon, everyone.
All rise.